Bang on the Empire Podcast this week. We go to Brooklyn with Saoirse Ronan, which is nice, while we also ask Bradley Cooper and Sienna Miller one big question.
How did it get burned?
Yes, how did they get burned? All that and more on the Movie Podcast that will not rest for 1 minute until Chewbacca gets his own Force Awakens poster, damn it. Now let's grab a bite to eat. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. You all know her. You all know how she makes a living. It's our geek queen, loving her dragons and her Winchesters. It's Helen O'Hara. How are you?
I feel like your heart isn't in it this week.
Well, I'll tell you why. Partially because I wrote the script on the tube.
Right.
And I was really struggling for an intro line for you.
Sure.
Okay. And then I realised that this week, it's not just the old stagers. It's not just you and I.
No.
We have, once again, an injection of fresh new blood for us to
glory
suck, for us to
bathe
basket.
No, bathe wait,
no,
anyway,
please welcome our other new junior online staff writer, John Nugent.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. Long time listener, first time podder.
Cool. Well, welcome to Empire.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here.
A couple of things. One of the reasons I didn't do an intro for Helen in my time-honoured fashion, because I wanted to introduce you as well, and then I wanted to ask about your first day at Empire, and then I wanted to ask about Helen's first day at Empire.
And just okay, get, you know,
so
sure.
That's why I'm not just making this stuff up, Helen.
Yeah,
all right,
you are, but it works, so let's go with it.
It says here, riff aimlessly for 5 minutes.
Well,
John,
you're right on point.
How long have you been at Empire now? 2 weeks?
Two,
week?
Just your second week. To my second week.
Your second week.
Yeah.
Right. What was your first day like? Were you terrified or were you okay?
It was surreal. It was very surreal. I've been reading Empire since I was 13 years old, probably.
Ditto.
I think my first copy was the Attack of the Clones cover with Christopher
Lee. We don't talk about that film. We don't talk
I don't
about
know. Don't, I can't remember who reviewed that. I
nicely
no.
played.
Hey.
You can keep the job. It's all good.
But no, the first day was, yeah, surreal, I think, is the main word. You spent most of it trying to come up with a nickname for me.
Yeah.
That work continues.
The work continues. To explain, John has a self-imposed nickname, The Nuge. You have a blog, don't you, The Nuge?
I do have a blog called The Nuge, yes.
That's not allowed here at Empire. You don't have your own nickname. We bestow a nickname upon you.
Yes.
So if you have any ideas out there, listeners, for what we could possibly call John, for example, Helen over the years has become Hell's Bells, Heleno, what else do we call you to your face? I can't remember. What am I? Do I have a nickname?
Neighbour, obviously.
Neighbour, and you know, Nick and I call each other
L-Man,
neighbor.
For no reason.
Phil calls me L-Man, Ali Wyber calls me C. Hughes. That's the polite ones to my face, but yeah.
I don't want to talk about the other one.
No, don't. So we can't allow John to come up with his own nickname. It's just not allowed. So if you can think of something that we can call the Nuge, Jane Nuge, John, then please do send him in. So otherwise, all good?
Otherwise, all good. No sexual harassment complaints yet.
Give it time.
It's early days. I mean to have you, boy, even if it must be burglary.
Oh.
Well, I'm quoting a film. What to do with quoting films? Helen, what was your first day like at Empire?
My first full day, I was actually sent off in the evening to cover the premiere of Peter Pan, the 2003 Peter Pan, which was a bit of a baptism of fire, but it was pretty awesome, you know, and it gave me a completely false expectation of how life was going to be, because it was one of those premieres where back in the day you could go to a premiere and you would get like 2 minutes chat with everybody in the cast. Nowadays, like 30 of you share 30 seconds chat. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I got a chance to talk to absolutely everybody involved in the film. I then got to sit and watch the film in the plush surroundings of the Empire Leicester Square. And then we even had invites to the freaking after party, which definitely never happens, and it was the one that the stars were actually at, which also never happens, and it was also because Mohammed Al-Fayed was a producer on the film, it was catered by Harrods. And it was literally just piles of sweets and deliciousness like everywhere. It was amazing. I actually talked to a Redgrave. I did. It was exciting.
Was it their dog? Sparky.
Yes,
Sparky Redgrave.
Yes,
what's that, Sparky? Vanessa's locked in the toilet?
Who's that good boy?
What year was that? Was that 2003?
It was 2003, December.
Okay, just to make you feel slightly old.
No, don't do that.
I think I was in year 11.
I was having my nappy changed.
I'm so old, I don't even know what year 11 is. We had like fifth form, so.
I was probably about 15 or 16.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
So were we, obviously.
When can we get rid of it?
We were prodigious.
How about your first day, Chris?
My first day, Helen. Thank you for asking. Was the Empire Awards 2001. I was plunged into the deep end and I was terrified and I wore my best, cheapest suit.
Wow.
And I'd literally just moved to London, I think the day before, maybe 2 days before, as I moved over the job. And I remember being utterly terrified. I remember everyone being really, really lovely. And I think I said this on Twitter before, but I had a list of questions I had to ask everybody. Mm-hmm. Like I had to go around the party afterwards and corral people and ask them stuff for the magazine. And I collared the League of Gentlemen and I forgot my questions. And I just, because I was so nervous. And I'd interviewed pretty big people. I'd interviewed, for example, the manager of the local football team in Banbridge. And I'd interviewed David Trimble.
Didn't you speak to Daniel Radcliffe's granny as well?
I mean,
big names.
Wow. Daniel Radcliffe's granny, because Daniel Radcliffe's dad is from my hometown. And Daniel Radcliffe, whenever he was announced as Harry Potter, I got on the phone with his sadly now dearly departed grandmother and got an exclusive interview with her.
I mean, this is no mean feat.
They don't call me Scoop McKenzie for nothing. So I rose to the middle of that particular trade, then went swiftly on to Empire. So then I dried up in front of the League of Gentlemen and Mark Gatiss touched me on the arm and went, "You're doing a lovely job." Because I'd said it was my first day and I was really nervous. And I also talked to Bryan Singer that day, I remember that. That was fun. And then I almost saw one of my colleagues at Empire, who shall remain nameless, naked from the waist down.
Wow.
Yeah, because they were all changing in a hotel room. We had a hotel room at the Dorchester.
Uh-huh.
And I was with a couple of people and we walked into the hotel room and this lady obviously hadn't put the lock on the door and she was bottomless and
good Lord.
Yeah, not in the manner of Mary Poppins' bag, but
no, I think we've all with
okay,
Chris.
Yeah, yeah. Should I draw you a picture? I have a picture.
No.
And luckily, my eyes were averted, so that was a close call.
Are we supposed to be wearing trousers now?
You'll fit right in, John.
You've learned too quickly.
You've got the vibe already. I love it. Well, welcome.
Thank you very much.
It is very good to have you. Right, we're going to have some questions now. One question sent in via Twitter from @R3TT3, which is either a way of saying Retta, or it's a droid from Star Wars who's become sentient, travel forward in time to a different galaxy, and started asking questions on Twitter.
Possible.
What are your favourite scenes involving a character wearing a disguise? The disguise need not be effective. Now, if either you don't say pistachio disguisey, then this is immediately over, because he is the master of disguise.
Well, you've already said it, so
I know.
Done.
But how do you know I am Chris Hewitt?
Oh my goodness!
Oh no, I am him.
Okay.
Okay.
I really enjoy bad disguises. I really enjoy, you know, when someone puts on a fake moustache and then passes unremarked by everyone around them. I think it's delightful. But, you know, I couldn't actually think of very many cases of that happening, at least on purpose. I mean, obviously, all the disguises in The Saint are terrible. Uh-huh. But I don't think they're deliberately so. Oh, brother, where art thou? Is probably the closest I can think of when you've got, you know, George Clooney pulling down his beard to reveal himself to the audience
the
as he sings.
The Song of Your Bottom Boys, yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
That's like a movie version of It Is I, Leclerc, from Hello, Hello, the guy who would come in every week in disguise. Yeah. Clearly a really, really terrible disguise.
I love Hello, Hello.
It's
The worst disguise ever has to be Superman. But he must just carry a cloud of credibility around him. That's the only way to really explain it. There's literally no other way it works. And then my other favourites, obviously Some Like It Hot and Mrs. Doubtfire, I think still work brilliantly, especially Some Like It Hot. And then Zoolander, when they use a tiny little portable mate travel case, remember? To create the most astonishing disguises. It's almost as if they're completely different people. It's amazing.
It's the power of makeup.
Yes. It is, yeah.
I wanted to know how we define a disguise. So does magic or technology count? For example, Loki, in basically every appearance in the MCU,
mm-hmm.
he sort of disguises himself as various people to get up to mischief.
Yeah, I think Loki is usually a right answer around here.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a disguise.
Yeah, especially when he disguises himself as Captain America.
Yes. You like that, don't you?
I do, yeah. Yeah. I've had that dream.
And also by a similar token, T-1000 in Terminator 2.
Yes.
He disguises himself via the magic of future technology.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed the Mars Attacks, the Martian who pretends to be
oh, yes.
a woman.
The way she walks.
Yeah, the creepy walk. She's great.
Lisa Marie.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. I think was Tim Burton's
she was, I believe,
girlfriend.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And she bites off Martin Short's finger. Which sounds like some dates I've been on.
Hey.
Hang on, you've been on dates, you've bitten off Martin Short's finger. Yeah, I love this is a great question. I love this question. And again, we're not going to be definitive, so send in the things we missed or got wrong later on. What about last week's Halloween questions? Is that they were all subjective. So no one could go, no, Chris, the film that scared you as a child was actually... Okay, there's loads. I mean, obviously, Inspector Clouseau was always disguised himself... with fat suits and whatnot. I love the disguise of Frank Drebin at the beginning of Naked Gun, where he's disguised as a waiter, and then he reveals himself and busts up a meeting of the world's most nefarious evil men. I love that scene so much. Return of the Jedi, Princess Leia disguises herself as the as the bounty hunter. Bush.
Yeah, no.
You mentioned fat suits. There's always the Big Mama's House saga.
We don't
saga.
Talk about that.
the trilogy.
Yep.
Big Mama's House, Big Mama's House 2, and Big Mama's House Like Father, Like Son, as we all know.
As we all know, absolutely. That's a classic. They always saw it as a trilogy. How can you have this category without talking about Dr. Peyton Westlake in Darkman? That's one of some of the best disguises are the ones where you know there's a race against time before the disguise in some way reveals itself, like Arnie in Total Recall when he's disguised as a woman and it all begins to malfunction. Yeah. 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
All that sort of stuff. Yeah. 2 weeks.
Actually, also Arnie in Junior, when he pretends to be a former member of the German women's shot put team, was it? Which is why he looks like a man who is pregnant.
Of course. Absolutely. And how can we not mention Bond, who's always disguised himself as, you know, whether it's a clown in Octopussy, Roger Moore dressed up as a clown, which is just ludicrous. And then possibly the most offensive of them all is when Sean Connery in You Only Live Twice disguises himself as a Japanese man by brushing his hair forward. And this is how they got away with this. I've no idea. He literally pulls his eyes up.
I mean, I want to say it was a more innocent time, but innocent really isn't the word. What is going on?
It was a time.
It was a racist time.
It's just staggering.
Yeah.
On a sort of less racist but Bondy note, the pre-title sequence from Russia with Love. The Spectre operative who we think is Sean Connery, but
Red Grant,
turns out, spoiler alert, he isn't. Spoiler for a 50-year film.
Similar opening in Mission Impossible 2. And in fact, Mission Impossible in general, like their disguises are really quite impressive. It's almost like they're not realistic, but except they are, of course.
I love the idea that in Mission Impossible, obviously now it's been explained away, they have a voice alterer.
Sure.
But at the same time, Ethan Hunt seems to have studied these people so much that he can actually assume their mannerisms and height, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, obviously.
He's that good.
He really is that good, Chris.
He is that good. There's tons and tons of disguises. I mean, the ex-presidents from, if you call that a disguise at the beginning of, well, throughout Point Break, we could be here talking about disguises all day.
The Joker as a nurse in Dark Knight.
The Joker as a nurse.
Yeah, he looked really good as a nurse.
He really pulled it off, I thought. Angelina Jolie in Salt.
Oh, yeah.
She's sort of very feminine man.
Yeah, she puts on a fake chin, which helps a little bit.
I had quite confusing feelings watching that. She's a very attractive man.
Well, that film started off as... Edmund Salt.
That's right. Yeah.
Started off as a Tom Cruise vehicle, and then he thought, hang on, this is a bit too close to what I've been doing for the last few years. But yeah, there are tons, and there are comedy ones that go wrong, and there are scary ones, and all sorts of stuff. And really, isn't the biggest disguise of them all, Helen, ourselves?
Oh my God, you're so deep.
Whoa.
Just throw it out there.
Just let that one sit.
Yeah, just let that one sit for a bit. Okay, if you want your question to be treated with the same level of respect we treated Retta's, which I thought was a very good question, send them in via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. And you can Facebook us, Empire Magazine. And you can email us as well, podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, time now for our first guests. Bradley Cooper and Sienna Miller started the year together in American Sniper, along with the creepy robot baby. And now they're ending it together in the chef drama Burnt, which was once known as Adam Jones. Phil DeSemlian went along to speak to them both this week. He did not bring with him a creepy robot baby. But do enjoy the interview.
Bradley Cooper, Sienna Miller, welcome to the Empire Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
To talk about Burnt.
Yes.
Which, before we get started on other things, the movie, it's had a few titles down in its iteration. Yeah. Obviously, Chef was one.
Yeah, the first one.
And then it became Adam Jones, and now it's Burnt. Do you have friends and family who think you've been doing three different movies and wondering where you found the time?
No, really, it just went from Chef to Burnt. Adam Jones was, I think, just a hold while they were discussing what the title was going to be.
That was out there, though, I feel like, for a while.
Do you get attached to film titles along the process?
No.
No. Just whatever.
Not whatever, but no, I wouldn't say get
not
attached.
Not whatever, but whatever it sort of is released as.
Right.
One. In this movie, obviously, you played Adam Jones, who is a chef, recovering alcoholic, and he's had some substance abuse problems. And Sienna, you play Helen, who's his sous chef, and they have obviously a slightly awkward relationship to kick off.
Yeah.
And it's full of amazing food, and people are going to come out of this movie salivating. One of the things I loved about it, delicious-wise, was the idea of the family meal in the restaurant where when they're not cooking the fancy food, they're cooking for each other.
Yeah.
And I wondered what you guys would cook for your family meal.
I always do kind of roasts and things like that. Every Sunday I'll do a roast and have an open house and lots of friends and family come over. Yeah, just things like that, comfort home food.
Okay.
I mean, it's usually some sort of stew, some sort of conglomeration of all the food that's been left over. You know, that's what the family meals usually are.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
That's the thing. You know, I grew up cooking in kitchens as a prep cook and, you know, feel pretty dexterous in the kitchen, love to cook. And then, you know, a 2 Michelin star restaurant going after its 3rd star is a whole other world. It's like a baseball team, you know, getting ready for the World Series. I mean, it's just like every single moment is so filled with pressure and intensity to a degree that I'm, you know, you just think, why? I mean, it's just so difficult. The amount of pressure, the sacrifice that chefs at that level, anybody who cooks in a kitchen at that level has to go through, it's just mind-blowing.
It looks terrifying. The film does an amazing job of conveying that. And the camera gets in amongst you guys.
Yeah.
Were there any awkward moments? Any kind of slip knives or...
Oh, all the time.
Stabs cinematographers?
Oh, yeah. We were constantly...
We got burnt all the time. Yeah, and Bradley cut his hand open, didn't you?
Yeah.
Did you?
A couple times, yeah. Well, on the plate, when he's smashing the plate. There was that time where he smashes 4 plates. On the second plate, the plate cracked and went in my hand, and then I kept going.
Ouch.
Yeah. Luckily, it was the last take.
Was it the last take of the film or the
No, it wasn't that severe of a gash.
Oh, okay.
No. Yeah. I was worried about the shucking oysters bit, and that was the first day of filming. Because if I don't know if you've ever shucked an oyster, but that is recipe for disaster. One slip and you're the knife's going right through your hand.
Oof.
And it's a jag. It's not really, you know, it's a jagged knife in a way. It's a thick knife that's a shucking oyster knife. And and I must have shucked, oh my gosh, 60, 70, 100 oysters that day. And they had 10 prepped for me, like that were a little loosened, but we went through those in about 10 seconds. And so the rest of the day, they're just sort of, everybody's sort of behind the monitor going, is this going to be the one that takes them down?
That's amazing. I always wondered when you're doing films, I mean, the skills that you can take on from what you learn preparing.
Yeah.
I'm hoping American Sniper isn't one of those ones, but you know, it's impressive. I know you can cook anyway, you guys, but...
No, we worked hard. I mean, we really... We would do 15 to 20 minute takes. You know, when you're not shooting on film, you have a lot more ability to do that. Mm. And it really was John Wells had set up a bunch of orders that day. The mise for everybody, everybody's place had been set for that food. And then I would call out the orders and they would roll camera and we would make the food. And if people were messing up, I'd have to go over there and deal with it, you know, as a commander of this brigade. And so it was a lot of cuts, a lot of mistakes, and a lot of pressure. But that was really the only way to do it, because otherwise it wouldn't have felt authentic, certainly not to us and not to you watching it. And we really do care about chefs, people in that world watching this movie, that they will sit there and say, oh yeah, no, there are no hand doubles, there are no cooking doubles, we can feel that this is real.
You have a special dish in this film, obviously the turbot.
Mm-hmm.
You've talked about dealing with turbots on a daily basis. It's like it's a fish like it's out of the James Cameron's The Abyss, isn't it? It's got these huge ugly eyes.
It's a really ugly fish, but it's also a really expensive fish. It's like a serious delicacy and absolutely delicious, but notoriously hard to fillet, so it's quite a cool skill to be able to do that.
Talking about American Sniper, you guys obviously worked together on that. That came out earlier in the year, so it's another partnership of you guys. I heard an interesting coincidence, which was that when you went to meet Clint Eastwood, you were driving to the studio and they played...
The Gorillaz song Clint Eastwood came on as I was driving through the Warner Brothers gates, and I was like, this has got to be a sign. It did kind of buoy me up a little bit. You know,
it is amazing how little moments in your life can just dictate the next 2 years or potentially 20.
Because
one experience, then we did Sniper and then Chef and now we're here. And if that hadn't happened, then this definitely wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, that's a really weird coincidence. Yeah.
Isn't that funny?
There's no song called John Wells, obviously. You're just unfortunately. Have you ever had any kind of weird serendipitous moment like that in your career that you can think of?
No.
I don't know if this is an unfair question, but do you have favourite movies of each other's performances that you particularly love?
I do, yeah. The Interview.
Right.
Heard of it.
Yes. I haven't seen The Interview.
That movie, that scared me.
Steve Buscemi directed it. It was just a two.
And stars in it, but it scared me, actually. Because her audition tape was incredible for Sniper, but I always thought, like, is she the woman from The Interview? Because it was so great, and she's nothing like her. But, man, she was so convincing. I mean, that was a terrifying character.
Aww. That's a bit like this, isn't it, The Interview? Stuck with a journalist.
You want to hope that it's not.
No.
Because you're the interviewer.
He's actually been brilliant in absolutely everything, but there is something mad. I mean, American Sniper for me was just transformative. It's just not the same person. And then I saw him in Elephant Man, and there was no way that was the same actor. But there is a real magic to me of his performance in Silver Linings Playbook. I love the energy of it. I love the guy. I just love that movie.
Pat Solitano.
Pat's great.
I want to go back and watch The Interview now, knowing you. I wonder how it'll be. It'd be so different, I bet. Yeah.
I'm not allowed to ask any questions about Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Are you?
I probably am, but definitely not on tape.
Do you have, it had amongst other things that people loved about it, had an amazing soundtrack.
Yeah.
You're a musical man. Do you have any tracks that you'd like to see on the second mixtape?
Oh, man, I would never speak for our director. And, you know...
Just speak for yourself, though. You could pick one that you love.
I don't, actually. I really don't know. I don't even know where it's going. I haven't seen a script. I have no idea. I'm as out of the loop as you are.
I do have a question that's sort of sequential to that, which is that your next movie, Dog's Purpose, you're voicing a dog.
Yeah.
And I wonder what Rocket would think of that.
He wouldn't care because he doesn't consider himself even a raccoon.
Ah, so he wouldn't.
No, he's a badass mercenary.
You've worked from an outsider's point of view. You guys have worked with really, you know, lots of very interesting directors. But David O. Russell and Bennett Miller, Foxcatcher, specifically, those two directors. There's a sort of perception of them that they're a little different in the way that they work. They're maybe a bit more intense, or the experience is a bit more draining for you as actors. Is that fair, or is that just a kind of a myth that's built up around them?
I'd say that Bennett, he's a very intense character and incredibly cerebral man and very measured. And I think that his way of telling stories is for the camera to really be a kind of voyeur, so it feels like there's another character just watching what's going on, and it's a very unsettling, very still, very patient way of making a film. And that set particularly was incredibly focused and serious and unpleasant, I think, for a lot of people, but I think that might have been intentional on his part. As a person, he's very sweet and kind.
Did you find that difficult?
To work on that film?
Yeah.
Yeah, the atmosphere was charged, but I think that served the film. And I was in brand new motherhood, so the whole thing is honestly a bit of a blur. But he's, I'd say, one of the greatest filmmakers. He's extraordinary.
And you're back with David on Joy, and you've had a very auspicious partnership with him so far.
I mean, he's like my brother. I love him. You know, we've done three films together, and he really... really allowed me to be a collaborator with him and a partner with him from the beginning, being able to executive produce Silver Linings and American Hustle. So, you know, I feel like I went to film school. I love him. I think, you know, he's changed my life, my career, the way I look at movies. I love the way he works. I've definitely taken everything from him and put it into every other movie I've done. if I ever get a chance to direct, I'll take so much of what I learned from the way he runs a set.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing Joy, seeing the next one.
Yeah.
I have to ask this. It's an annoying question, I know, but American Sniper, obviously, a huge, huge hit. Like, I think after Saving Private Ryan, the biggest war movie, U.S. war movie.
I think it's the biggest
U.S. war movie, yeah. Box offices. All the awards buzz, great movie, people loved it. Are you aware of the baby meme that sort of grew up around
that? No, never heard about that.
No, okay, fair enough.
Of course we are.
what was your feelings about that? Was that just one of those things that was an annoying kind of...
I mean, on the day?
Yeah,
because we thought it would, you know, be solved by visual effects in the end. But, you know, you just, you know, you're there and you do... I don't know, to be truth, we were in such a zone.
Yeah.
It didn't even matter, honestly. Like, I don't know, I felt kind of... that whole experience. I remember those days... It didn't even matter, remember? I mean, it was just like, I don't know, she was so dropped into Taya. And, you know, we're playing real people.
Yeah.
And there was such a huge responsibility I thought it would just be fixed in the end, you know? It was an unfortunate thing that it wasn't.
Watching the movie, it's distracting. And I think it was an error that it, you know.
Yeah. Have you guys had conversations about a third project together?
We've talked about maybe doing a play one day.
Yeah.
If Bradley directs, I would love to be directed by him.
I would love to do anything with her.
I think we'll work.
I think for sure. Maybe the next thing.
Last question. You have both worked in restaurants. I was just going to ask how you'd have done it working at Adam Jones.
Oh, God. Horribly.
Really?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I don't want to work there.
No.
Now, do you?
No.
No.
God, no.
God, no.
No, it looks...
Absolutely
it looks,
not.
It looks miserable.
Maybe by the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe.
By the end, it looks nice.
Yeah, you never see any puddings in that movie, which is a shame because I imagine the puddings are amazing.
Cake.
The cake.
Oh,
the cake,
really?
Obviously.
Yeah, there's two cakes. Actually, there's a great shot of it. It was my favorite. I actually made that cake in real time during the scene. And that was fun. That was really fun.
Because
they had this other cake that they were going to put in. And I said, well, let me take a crack at it. And the cake I made worked out perfect. So that's what's in the movie. That was fun. And it was just fun always to do that. And I love that shot of the chocolate being dipped around. And I always wondered how they made that and look so perfect. You know, but you drain the chocolate and it fits. Did you ever wonder that? I thought,
how do they
do it with no crease or anything?
Well, it doesn't just all gather around the bottom like a moat.
Yeah, but it drains.
Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah.
You'll learn many things from this movie. Sienna Miller and Bradley Cooper, thank you so much for joining the Empire Podcast.
No, thanks for having us.
Thanks.
That was Bradley Cooper and Sienna Miller. We'll be talking about Burnt later on in the review section. I suspect we're going to give it 3 Michelin stars. Shall we talk about some movie news now?
Sure.
Okay, let's do that.
All right.
So what's been happening this week?
Well, there's been some good news, some bad news, some something in the middle there. There was news of The Crow, which is sort of relevant because Corin Hardy, obviously we had him back on our live podcast in Edinburgh in the summer. Mm-hmm. His film The Hallow is out, I think, next week, isn't it? His very scary
Correctamundo
movie, which I saw this week. And his next movie, The Crow, finally has a start date. It's going to shoot, we are told, in March. So it was caught up for a long time there. When Relativity Media was the studio that's kind of funding it, was shut down. The remake of The Crow seemed to be one of the films affected, but it now seems to be back on for the first quarter of next year. Now, we still don't actually know who's going to be starring. He did talk to, was it you, Chris, the current issue?
Yes, I went down to Corin's house, actually, in near Brighton.
Cool.
It's an awesome, he's got a pretty awesome man cave. The sort of man cave you would not like to be trapped in on a dark, windy night, because it's full of scary toys and whatnot.
Sure.
It's a horror fan's house, a haven. It's really, really cool. But we chatted for a long time about The Hallow, which is really good, and obviously The Crow as well. Some things I can say, some things I can't say. But I'm really glad of this happening. If it hadn't happened, I think he would have been okay. I think he would have directed a film he's been trying to make for years called The Refuge, which is a Yeti movie, which sounds pretty damned awesome as well. But he's, as anyone who listened to the live podcast from Edinburgh knows, he is a huge Crow fan. At the age of 17, he would dress up as The Crow, as Eric Draven, he would go, you know, and pretty uncannily as well. So this is a character and a property that's in his blood, so to speak, and I think he's very much the right choice to do it. And they came so close before the money dried up. So it's good to see it back on the road.
Definitely. And yeah, so we'll talk about, I guess, The Hallow next week. A little bit of casting replacement news for The Girl on the Train. So this adaptation of the bestseller, it has its lady cast is in place. Emily Blunt is still there. Rebecca Ferguson is still there. Edgar Ramirez, Allison Janney. But Jared Leto has left due to a scheduling conflict. That follows the departure of Chris Evans,
yes,
as well.
He was replaced by Justin Theroux. One of these things is not like the others.
I know, indeed. And now Jared Leto is being replaced by Luke Evans.
Okay.
Now, good guy. We like him a lot.
Yeah.
Again, a slightly different energy. So,
Who was once attached to Billy the Crow, of course.
He was, yes.
Yeah. Maybe Jared Leto's gone to Billy the Crow. That's how rumours start.
We start them. No, that's wrong. We try not to. Anyway.
Can't believe Jared Leto's a crow. That's amazing.
Calm down, Chris. Just deep breath. But yeah, so that's an interesting addition to that cast. It really is getting very close now. It's due out on October 7th, 2016. So just under a year now to go. And what else have we got? In other good news, Elizabeth Banks has signed up to another role. She's going to be starring in Rita Hayworth with a Hand Grenade, which is a new, rather interesting sounding kind of take on war movie. She's going to be playing a conflict photographer called Caroline Baker in a sort of riff on John Borman film, Hell in the Pacific, which was also kind of remade as, was it Enemy Mine?
It was remade as Enemy
Mine.
The
sort of alien version of the same.
Yep.
Anyway, her character Baker gets shot down over a Pacific island, presumably during World War II. We're guessing, and is marooned with only a Japanese soldier for company.
Wow. Yeah, that is. I mean, Hell in the Pacific. Go back and listen to the John Borman podcast we had. We talked quite a bit about that. That experience of shooting that film was traumatic for him for many reasons. One, that Toshiro Mifune, the great Japanese actor who was in it, just had nothing but contempt for John Borman. You go back and read about the making of this film. It's incredible. And go back and listen to the John Borman interview. So hopefully there won't be quite such a, he would refuse to take direction, he wouldn't speak in English to him, all that sort of stuff. It's amazing that the film came out as well as it did, and I hope that nothing as traumatic befalls this movie.
Indeed, cool.
We've got some Star Trek news. Star Trek is returning to the small screen.
So excited.
Cowabunga.
Yeah.
2017, we're getting a new show.
We don't know much about it yet, do we?
We know basically nothing. We know we know that Alex Kurtzman is at least executive producing it. Mm-hmm. He was a writer on the two rebooted movies, Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness.
He was.
And we know that it's on CBS All Access, which is like a sort of streaming service for CBS, which is an interesting move. It won't be on regular TV, at least at first.
Maybe that means they'll have finally the hardcore swearing and sex that Star Trek has lacked before. Alex Kurtzman, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I haven't really been keeping up with this, but I imagine this hasn't got Star Trek fans that excited, because I think they see him as an enemy, don't they, really? I mean, he's certainly tainted with a brush. After Star Trek Into Darkness.
I think there is that bit of schism, isn't there, between the sort of talky science of the TV show and the explodey action of the recent movies, which Kurtzman has been a part of.
But then I think, I mean, the 2009 Star Trek was great.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it was great. It was a very, very clever take on the mythology. It managed to both completely respect the timeline and totally reinvent it, which is a trick I'm still impressed by. And Kurtzman and Orsi were, you know, a big part of that. They always said that Orsi was the one with the green blood.
Yeah, that's the
interesting
thing.
He was the bigger fan. But I hope that, I mean, I think Kurtzman's had enough exposure now that I would imagine he's got, you know, a fair amount of knowledge about the show.
Mm.
And I just hope that, yeah, we can bring it back to that sort of science-y stories that do work better on the small screen. I mean, yes, I mean, when we go to the cinema, we want to, you know, a certain amount of bang for our buck. But on the small screen, some of those small Star Trek stories are still some of the greatest pieces of storytelling that you'll see. And it's no coincidence that shows like Next Generation, DS9 and Voyager launched the careers of a hell of a lot of people who are now in charge of essentially the TV renaissance. You know, people like Ronald D. Moore, they all came out of this. Star Trek used to have an open door policy on scripts. So people like Marty Noxon, who went on to write for Buffy, were able to submit scripts to this show as it was happening. And that's a pretty amazing thing. And hopefully if they get some of that kind of spirit back and that kind of talent, then this can be amazing.
I wonder if that would happen these days. When you look back at Next Gen, for example,
yeah,
it's very episodic. And nowadays, TV tends to be, it tends to have arcs, and everything tends to be about a 22 episode arc.
But even,
you know, it was almost like a space procedural in a way, Star Trek.
But even, I mean, so by the end of The Next Generation, there were beginning to be more sort of arc stories.
Yeah, obviously.
And
yeah.
DS9 was all about the arc in the lighter seasons. Because it's all about that arc. Mm. About that arc. No,
it's all about
episodes. Sorry.
But
I think, yeah, if they sort of build on that, they could be on something kind of interesting. And I just, I'm hopeful. I'm not, you know, complacent yet, but I'm really hopeful for this.
There has been some speculation that with Kurtzman involved, it could be a sort of spin-off from the movies, from the rebooted series. Do you think that could happen?
So what, you know, John Cho goes off on his own adventures?
Yeah,
kind of thing.
Or even a sort of alternate universe Next Generation or something where we see sort of rebooted Picard.
I would not. I really wouldn't. But, you know, I'm sure they'll come up with something. I would try and find a new spin on it. I mean, there's been talk for years of a sort of Starfleet Academy kind of show. That was mooted for ages and ages. Maybe do something like that. Maybe do Starfleet Headquarters. Mm. That would be interesting, actually, because you could have all of these, you know, Maverick captains off in deep space doing their own thing. We kept having in The Next Generation, particularly, you'd have these admirals coming in and causing trouble. Let's see why.
Yeah, I'd hope they would do something new. Although they'd be daft as well at some point if they didn't reboot Picard.
Who would you cast? Jason Statham.
Jason. Make it so. No,
make it so, you mug.
Put the kettle on Errol. I know that's not Jason Statham. Anyway, but yeah, cool. What else?
We do have a much sadder news that came through last night, which is the death at only 65 of Melissa Matheson. Who, of course, is best known as the screenwriter of E.T. She also wrote films like The Black Stallion, The Indian in the Cupboard, Kundun. She did the English translation of Ponyo, which is a gorgeous little film. And she has one still to come with Spielberg's adaptation of Roald Dahl's The BFG. Mm-hmm. I mean, 65 is young these days. It felt like she was still going strong. And I think The BFG was going to be a little bit of a, you know, a boost again and get her back in the spotlight. And I'm very, very sad to hear this. If she had only ever done E.T., it would be a great loss.
Absolutely.
Frankly. And she did a lot more.
She broke my heart when I was age 6, that woman.
Yeah.
Phenomenal screenplay for E.T. when you think about it, when you really sit down. I mean, that's a difficult movie to nail tonally. And yes, obviously Spielberg did a lot as well, but the screenplay does a lot of the heavy lifting.
Do we know if she'd finished her work on the BFG?
I believe so, yes.
So we'll get to see her swan song, I suppose.
Yes.
Because that's got to be good, isn't it? Well, I'm feeling hopeful for that film.
I'm feeling very positive about that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's Spielberg and it's the BFG. And
that's, you know, a dream team, isn't
that's
it?
That's a pretty dream team. And then you've got Matheson on the script duties. Yeah, that one, I'd be amazed if that isn't good. So I think that will be, hopefully that will be a very fitting memorial.
Fantastic screenwriter and a very, very sad loss. And you're absolutely right. No age at all. Melissa Matheson, who died yesterday, aged 65. Okay, and there's some other things to talk about as well. So, there were Star Wars posters that came out yesterday. It's always fun to talk about posters and trailers on a podcast. But there were 5 character posters, and in fact, I referred to it at the beginning of the podcast. Chewbacca is not one of them.
What?
What the hell's going on?
Second round. He's the big finale.
Don't get me started. Chewbacca's my favourite character, but yes, I have a Yoda lightsaber umbrella.
Uh-huh.
And yesterday, I cut myself on it, which felt like a betrayal.
Right.
Sorry, cut myself on my lightsaber umbrella. I did.
Okay.
But yeah, I just wanted to let you know that. But so who were the 5 posters?
It was Harrison Ford as Han Solo, Carrie Fisher as Leia.
With lens flare.
With lens flare.
All obscuring their eyes. That's what we should point out.
An eye in each.
An eye. Yes, their right eye.
There was John Boyega as Finn. Daisy Ridley as Rey.
Yep.
And Adam Driver in his Kylo Ren mask.
It could just be the mask. We don't even know.
Well,
he's in there.
Yeah, maybe it's Chewie under there.
There you go, Chris. He's there after all.
Chewie would never turn to the dark side. Do we all know that?
He's just in disguise.
Oh, that's good. Oh, that works.
Or maybe it's Luke under there.
Let's not get into conspiracy theories. Let's not go there. No,
that's what the internet want me to believe.
No, stop it. Put it down the well, get in the sea, etc. So what do we think of the posters? Then this fairly strange affectation where everyone's covering their right eye. Why are they doing that?
Well, there's a few people on our Facebook page mentioned maybe they're just the optician or something. They're getting their eyes tested.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
It's very important in space because the radiation could damage your retina.
This is true.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's just a stylish choice, you know.
But why?
Because you want to have the lightsabers and the blasters in there.
It's and visual where consistency,
else do you fit,
isn't
where
it?
Else do you fit them in a tiny little poster?
But why the right eye? What does it signify?
Is it a tribute to the dearly departed left eye of TLC?
Helen, how many times do I have to tell you? Don't go chasing waterfalls. Don't do it. No.
Well, I mean,
I'm going to rule that one out right away.
What's your theory? Come up with your theory.
My theory, Helen, is that it indicates that we're not seeing the full picture.
Okay.
And neither are they. And that there is something in The Force Awakens that is hidden from us all.
But like a Phantom Menace.
Yes.
Like I'm so sorry.
But it's standing to our right. So
so whoever's on the right of the... is it Ant or Deck that we should be worried about in that
Ant.
Case? It's Ant.
Okay, from the viewer's point of view, Deck is on the right. How have we gone to this? But from Deck's point of view, Ant is on his right. So it's all about perspective, isn't it? It's all about Helen, I've got to say it, from
who's,
a certain point of
got
view.
The one with less hair? That's how I tell. Isn't it Deck? Deck's got a receding hairline.
See, how have we got on to discussing Ant and Deck?
Because one of them always stands on the right.
It's my fourth favourite subject, but all right, I'll tell you about Ant and Deck. Born in 1971. No, I don't know how old they are. What else should we talk about very quickly?
We should mention very quickly that the best movie Batman of all time, by which, of course, I mean Will Arnett's Lego Batman, is obviously getting his own film. And he now has an Alfred, and that will be played by Ralph Fiennes, which seems like awfully good casting.
Does this just seem like this is the Batman film you want to see?
This is my Batman film. Honestly, Will Arnett. Okay, I mean, Michael Keaton, you know, we can argue about which of them is better, but basically it's Will Arnett all the way for me. And
Michael Cera as Robin. That's just perfect.
On board. Rosario Dawson as Batgirl. Zach Galifianakis is apparently still circling the role of the Joker. But yeah, I'm thrilled.
And then the last thing we're going to talk about this week, is we've got loads of things to get through. Alicia Vikander is potentially Lisbeth Salander, not just because it rhymes, but Sony are looking at making another Girl with the Dragon Tattoo movie based on the most recent book that came out, The Girl in the Spider's Web, which was not written by Stieg Larsson because, you know, obviously, reasons, but was written by someone. Who was it written by?
David Lagercrantz.
David Lagercrantz.
Apologies if I'm not pronouncing that correctly.
And it just came out, and it's another book about Mikhail Blomkvist, played by Daniel Craig, of course, in the David Fincher movie, and Lisbeth Salander, another adventure for them, and of course, played by Rooney Mara in the David Fincher movie, which did well at the box office, but not well enough to warrant an immediate sequel or indeed the completion of that trilogy. So I'm intrigued if Sony are indeed going ahead, that they're skipping the rest of that trilogy, going straight to this book, which I haven't read, but from what I understand, wasn't brilliantly received.
I have a theory that sometimes, you know, moderately good books are the ones to adapt. I don't think you should probably try to adapt classics. Most of the time, they turn out better. Jaws is, of course, a perfect example. The Godfather, not a bad example either.
But Alicia Vikander, of course, actual Swede.
True. And she's made what I think 6 of her films have been released this year. In the end, I think one or two moved into next year. At one point, it was looking like 8, but I mean, she's only got like 2 films lined up for next year, so she must have a hole in her schedule.
She must be kicking herself. She must be going around the house going, I don't know what I'm doing. I haven't shot 4 films this week. What's happening?
Slowed down massively.
Do we think though, Noomi Rapace is the ultimate incarnation of that character? You know, as much as I love the Fincher film, and I love Fincher, but it did sort of feel slightly redundant. It was almost a sort of really close remake to that, to the Swedish original.
I think the Swedish one was still the best.
I mean, she's the first, clearly. I preferred her version of that character to Rooney Mara's, but I don't know. Clearly they want to keep on doing it. Okay, that's it for movie news. Tons of movie news. We're going to have another guest now. Saoirse Ronan has been one of the best actresses around since she burst onto the scene with an Oscar nomination for Atonement when she was 13. She's now 21. Since then, her choices have been largely impeccable, working with some great directors and some very, very good films. She's at it again with John Crowley's Brooklyn, in which she plays a young Irish woman torn between the old world, Ireland, and a new Brooklyn. I went along to speak to her recently, and my accent immediately got 89% ticker, so it did. Word of warning, a rogue mobile phone may intrude upon this interview every now and again. We couldn't track down the culprit. It wasn't me.
Really?
It wasn't me.
Wow.
So who does that leave?
Saoirse Ronan.
Just saying. Enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Emperor Podcast by Saoirse Ronan, star of Brooklyn. How are you?
I'm grand. How are you?
I'm not too bad, not too bad. I find this thing happens when I talk to fellow Irish / Northern Irish people, and my accent just gets noticeably thicker.
I know. It's actually gotten thicker in the last minute or so.
The minute I walked into the room, it just got a little bit thicker.
It did.
I'll start saying ticker in a second as well.
Happening before my eyes.
Before your very eyes. Does that happen to you? Is that a phenomenon that happens to you when you're...
Yeah. I wasn't even sure when you came in. I was trying to figure out where you are from. But isn't it mad though when that happens when Irish people get together, like automatically... You get like hyper Irish, you know, the Irishness is upped big time.
Yeah.
And even yesterday we did a Q&A at BAFTA and myself and Colm and Nick and Fionnuala and all of them, we were chatting away and all of a sudden I mentioned something, this thing that John had said to me. We were doing all these dinner scenes in Mrs. Keogh's in the boardroom kind of thing, you know, and it was the only time that we almost got into an argument with each other when he said to me, right, you know, I don't want you to eat your stew with a spoon, I want you to eat it with a fork.
Right.
And I thought, who eats their stew with a fork? I've never heard of anyone eating their stew with a fork. And I said it to him and I was like, it was incredulous. I was kind of like, what do you mean? I wouldn't eat it with a fork. Would you eat it with a fork? And it went around the whole room and everyone was divided on it. And I brought it up last night and it's a touchy subject for both of us. And all of a sudden, Colm chimed in and he was on my side and we just got so Irish. It was amazing.
Yeah. Well, the answer is spoon, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
I've never heard of someone eating
a fork. How are you supposed to eat the soup?
What sort of barbarian does that?
John Crowley, apparently. Maybe it's a cork thing. I don't know.
Let's not start any wars. That would be a bad idea.
The war has already begun.
It certainly has. It certainly has. But the film, The Brookman, is a fantastic film. It's really moving and emotional and packs quite a punch. And did it have more of an emotional impact for you than I imagine most other films you've done, you know, given that you started off your journey in life in New York? I'm sure you don't remember it. You were very, very young, obviously, but you've done that journey in reverse.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, initially that was a huge draw for me, and I was very conscious of finding the right first Irish project to do. This was the first Irish film that I did, and it was very important for me to make sure that felt right. And of course, when this came along, the fact that it was about an Irish-American relationship really spoke to me. But I have to say, you know, it was another year or so before we actually made the film. Mm-hmm. And when we had made it, about 8 months before, I moved over to London and was really right in the middle of that homesickness and that grief that, you know, we've all felt when you leave home. And I think the thing that really strikes you when you move away at first is the realization that you're not able to go back. You know, you can't quite go back to how it was before, and that's scary, and you don't know how long this feeling is going to last for. And so I wasn't over that by any means when I was making the film, and I was in such a kind of emotional place that I couldn't separate the two, you know.
Where did you shoot the film?
We shot the Irish segment in Enniscorthy, which is where it's set. Mm-hmm. And then we did 1 week in Dublin. We did some studio stuff there. Mm-hmm. And then we went to Montreal for about 4 weeks to shoot 1950s Brooklyn, because 2015 Brooklyn is like hipster city. So
it's a typical bit of movie magic.
Yeah, exactly.
Films called Brooklyn is set largely in Brooklyn.
Yeah, shoots in Montreal.
Shoots
in Montreal. Makes sense. We did 2 days in New York. We did 1 day on Coney Island because, you know, you couldn't fake anywhere else for Coney. And then we shot on Clinton Street for our very last few scenes together, myself and Emery. So,
and was it important to you in a way to set foot in New York, even for just a smidgen?
It really was, you know. I moved back from New York when I was 3 years old, but the first time I properly went back after that was when I was about 14. Mm. And I had an instant connection to this place. Like, it felt right to be here. And, you know, Ireland will always be my home first and foremost, but New York, it does feel like a second home, and it always has done. And the idea of not shooting any of it in New York was kind of mental. So it was really nice that we got to end it there. And my mum actually came over because it was around the time of her birthday. And so I brought her over for the last couple of days to New York. And, you know, that was very much hers and my dad's experience over there. And she really felt like the film captures that, you know, that feeling that you get when you move over to the States, especially from a small place like Ireland, you know. And I said to her when she came over that I really wanted to finish this experience by going to Ellis Island. I had never been to Ellis Island. Okay. Took us forever to get to Ellis Island. The queue was like 2 hours long.
You know,
if you're going to Ellis Island, make sure that you get the tickets first and then queue up, because people queue up and they think they're going to get their tickets, but they're not. It's very confusing. Anyway, eventually we got there, and it was amazing for me to learn about all these other cultures and all these other different types of people who had come through Ellis Island. I always assumed that it was just kind of the Irish really that had gone through there, and it just made me appreciate on a whole new level this community, you know, through better or worse, that New York had become, you know, and that it always was really.
Absolutely. Well, it's such an amazing place. But obviously you're going back to New York as well for The Crucible.
I am. I'm going back in January.
Yeah, that's going to be pretty exciting. That's a hell of a play.
Tell me about it. Yeah, it's a little nerve-wracking, I've got to say. I'm very scared, but I was very scared going into Brooklyn as well, and it was the most, you know, gratifying experience. So I am dying to get into it, I have to say.
What's scary about it?
The unknown, I think. I mean, I know how I prepare myself for film. I know what to expect. I know how I work on a film set. I don't know how I'll work on stage and what I'll need or anything like that. And I guess just, you know, with theatre, no matter what technique does need to come into it somehow, the physicality is important, and the whole idea of, you know, projection of your voice is something I'll have to get used to. So, and also I'm just terrified of fluffing up my lines. That's honestly, I've had nightmares about it, and I haven't been able to sleep. Honestly, for the last year or so, I've like, there's been times where I just can't get to sleep because I'm worried I'm going to fluff up my lines.
Do you fluff up your lines on a regular basis on a movie set?
No.
Well, there you go. You'll be fine.
But it's because I know that I have another take. Do you know what I mean?
And you can compartmentalise your lines as well. You know, that's today's lines, tomorrow is another.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. But the only thing is with theatre is that it's so repetitive and you're doing so much rehearsal that hopefully it'll be ingrained in my brain by the time we actually start the run. So
you'll know everyone else's lines as well.
It'll be that's
awesome.
What Mam said, yeah.
So who's your John Proctor again?
Ben Whishaw.
Ben Whishaw.
No big whoop. Whatever. He's all right, I guess.
And Sophie Okonedo.
Kieran Hines.
Yeah, that's not a bad cast.
It's all right, yeah.
Have you started rehearsals, or are you going to start when you go over in January?
Yeah, in January.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So you don't have the text up here yet?
No, but there. I'm going to start now next week when I go back. I'm going to start. I'm getting nervous now just even thinking about it.
No, I should stop talking about it. But I will say that I was Reverend Hale in a university production.
Were you?
And I knocked it out the park.
I'd say you did. I bet you did.
Absolutely. It's still going the ball. But you'll be fine.
You seem like a Hale man.
Yep, I do, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not quite a John Proctor.
No, not quite a John Proctor. But Hale's important too.
He's very important.
So if you come and see the play, are you going to be very, very critical of us?
Especially of Bill Camp.
Let's see if he's got the goods, you know.
I'd be heckling, you know. But you know.
Oh, come on. You can't say it like that.
It'll all be fine.
What's he doing?
But your process when you're choosing stuff, you say that Brooklyn's your first Irish film. I mean, I guess in a way I almost thought of Byzantium as an Irish film for you. Obviously, Neil Jordan, you shot a lot of it in Dublin as well. But it's interesting, you don't consider it to be an Irish film.
No, it's not. It's not even that. What I mean by it being my first Irish film is that it's set in Ireland and I'm playing an Irish person.
Yeah.
So no, Byzantium is very much, I mean, it's a part Irish production and we shot pretty much all of it in Ireland apart from one week in Hastings, and I was so happy to be shooting at home, and our crews at home are terrific, and it was an Irish film, but this was an Irish story, and this was my first time playing an Irish woman, and that was very new for me, and so it was important to make sure it was the right project, you know.
So how do you go about that? Is it just a gut feeling? Or, because I imagine you've been sent a lot of Irish scripts over the years.
I've been sent a few and they just haven't felt right, or maybe it wasn't quite the right fit and we were trying to make it work just for the sake of it, or, you know, whatever. And I didn't want to do that really, you know. But I do think you have to, I think really the only thing you can rely on at the end of the day is your instinct, is your gut feeling with most things, not just with work or, you know, for me with picking out a script, but with relationships, with where you want to live, with you know, what pair of socks you're going to buy, you know, all that kind of stuff. Stand to your good instinct at the end of the day. These ones feel right, but also a lot of other things come into it, a lot of other elements, you know, the director and who's involved in making it, because if this film was put in the wrong hands, it could have turned into this melodramatic, soppy film, and it's really not that at all, because it was in the right hands. It was made by the right people for the job, you know.
And in terms of the role itself, in terms of Eilish, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, you've had lead roles in the past, and but this one, you're on screen for almost every single scene. I think there's maybe two scenes in the movie in which you're not a part of them. What sort of burden was that for you? And, you know, as you're going throughout your career, are you getting better at handling the burden of more and more scenes? And
I mean, it's never a burden to have loads of scenes. You know, and it's honestly, it's not even in a kind of ego way. I love being in every single day. I've done a couple of things where I've played, where it's been an ensemble cast, and it's been so much fun to do that stuff. But I started out, you know, doing films where I was in from start to finish. And to feel like you're grafting along with everyone else and you're working as hard as the crew are, and you're there for the very start of this journey to the very end, makes it very special, and you put so much into it, you know. And I think with this, the pressure that I put on myself came from the fact that we were shooting it at home, and as I said, it was my first kind of Irish role, I guess, is what I should say, maybe. But the whole thing of like being in every scene, I love that, you know. I love, because it gives you time, even though with something like this every supporting role is so well written and well rounded, when you're in from beginning to end, it gives you so much time to work out what you want to do and really get to kind of grow with that character and with the people that you're working with. And there was one film I did a few years ago, it was with Colin actually, and they had started about a month before me. And I remember I came in on the first day and I was shooting on it for about 6 weeks or something like that, out of say the 10 weeks. But the idea of coming in a month later when everyone had gotten to know each other, they all knew how the other one worked, and, you know, the crew knew the cast and vice versa. For me to walk into that, I felt very strange because I wasn't used to that at all.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Whereas this way, you got to watch other people do that. You got to watch Jim Broadbent come into the situation for a week or so, or Donald Gleeson for a couple of weeks, I imagine.
Yeah.
So
the
shoe was on the other foot. So I mentioned Donald Gleeson, obviously. This was filmed, I'm guessing, around... He had just finished Star Wars, or he was about to do Star Wars.
He was about to do
Star Wars.
Yeah.
Obviously, you had quite famously, quite publicly, gone up for Star Wars as well. Did you have a chat about it at all? Was that something?
No,
that
well, it's gas because it was such a public thing. I think someone mentioned it. They asked me had I gone up for Star Wars, and I was like, yeah, and like so did everyone else that was my age and older and younger. I mean, JJ saw everyone for it. It wasn't. I read the same scenes that everyone else read, and it wasn't like I was on a top list or, you know, anything like that. Yeah. We all went in for it. I was living in London at the time. The scenes were sent out via courier to everyone. You brought them back in with you. You shredded them. Oh no, actually you had to return them, I think, after you read them. It was nuts. Like, it was mad. So exciting to go in and pretend you had a lightsaber in your hand and all the rest of it. But like, everyone goes in for that stuff. Every big studio film, there can be such a big thing made out of it. But like, if there's a female role that's between the age of, you know, 16 and 25, chances are me and most other actresses will be seen for it. So.
Right, okay.
But we couldn't talk about it because we didn't know when he was still on the film. And I think he like disappeared one day. And we didn't, he wasn't working, I don't think, or they had to change the schedule, whatever it was, anyway, he wasn't in. And all of a sudden we heard on set, oh yeah, Donald's in Star Wars. And he had found out a few days before that and he couldn't tell anyone. So he'd like come into set and he couldn't tell anyone he was in feckin' Star Wars, you know.
How did you react when he arrived back?
I was annoyed he didn't tell us. Yeah.
It's a shame. It's a real shame. Real shame.
It is. It is.
But, it's interesting. I mean, even the fact that you, and as you say, you know, if any role like that comes up, then you'll be in contention because the roles you've chosen so far, that you look throughout your career, are not those big studio blockbuster films.
No.
But that is something that you would do.
Yeah, I would do it if it was the right thing. You know, I mean, I'm not seeking out those kind of films necessarily, and I'm also not avoiding them, you know, or making a point of not doing a big film, you know. It's the security that you get with something like a studio film or a Star Wars or, you know, something of that type is that, you know, it's probably going to get released and someone's going to see it. And I, you know, 9 times out of 10, the films that I've done have been very, very small and done on a very, very tight budget. And some of them are great and everyone works really hard on them and nobody gets to see them, whether it's down to the promotion for it or, you know, the money people come in and they don't know what the demographic is or they don't know what the audience is or whatever. It drives you mad when they try and pigeonhole the films, you know, and I know I can understand because there's a lot of films that are just made for, okay, it's for this audience, it's for the YA group, or this is for the, you know, 18 to 25 or whatever it is. With something like Brooklyn, the amount of men and young boys who have watched it, who have responded to it just as much as women have, because it's a universal story and it's also done in Nick's kind of classic style of just writing about a life, you know, and what happens in a life. And that's something that anyone can relate to when it's not gender specific, really.
No, absolutely, agreed. And your performance in the movie has generated O-word buzz. Having been nominated already for an Oscar, obviously it's very hard to speculate about what might happen.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to talk about your last experience, actually, of being nominated for an Oscar, because I imagine it must have been quite surreal.
It was, you know. I mean, it happened when I was 13, you know, and I was a child, and I had been working for a few years, and I think to me, I mean, it happened and it was amazing. I was in New Zealand at the time and I was shooting Lovely Bones, and Dad stayed up all night waiting to see if I'd been nominated, and Mam and I were like, yeah, we're going to sleep because we've got to go to work tomorrow. And then all of a sudden we were fast asleep and we heard Dad go, yes, yes, and he was like freaking out. And we came downstairs and you know, got the news. And it was brilliant. And I was kind of like, oh, great, we get to go to the Oscars. I've been watching that on the telly since I was like 4. And really, I think, genuinely, I think that's why it excited me back then, is because I watched it on the telly.
Right.
You know, television's so exciting. And so, yeah, it was terrific. But I think, like, Mam has said to me, she said it to me at the time and she said it to me since, that she's really glad I didn't win. I mean, I was never going to win, and that wasn't kind of, that wasn't going to happen. But she was glad I didn't, because I was a kid and I was too young, and I hadn't had a bunch of experience yet, and I hadn't worked for long enough for it to really, truly mean something. And I always think about, you know, Scorsese when he finally got his Oscar, and Jesus, what that must have meant to him. Somebody who is one of the greatest filmmakers on earth and has made some of the best, most memorable films, but he's also dedicated himself to it and worked at it for such a long time, and, and his work is so beloved that when he finally got it, it meant more than just, oh, you made a great film, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
So,
but imagine if you had one, it would have been a hell of a doorstop.
Well, yeah, no, it would have been great. Now, I wouldn't have said no to it. Like,
I reject this Oscar.
No, I don't want it.
I'm too young. I can't handle it. You take it back.
No.
Saoirse Ronan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
So there you go, Saoirse Ronan. I hope the mobile phone didn't intrude upon your enjoyment of that interview too much, or indeed the thick Irish accent. Subtitles are available at www.phildesimlian.com. He has a subtitling service and he'll do it for a reasonable price. Okay, so let's talk about the movies that are out this week. Last week's review section was a bit of a farce.
It was a Howling Wasteland, Chris.
It was, wasn't it? Because Spectre came out and there wasn't a lot out. And anyway, but this week, lots of films.
Mm.
Before we go on, I will say that the Spectre spoiler special is out on Monday, featuring Sam Mendes waxing lyrical about all the big twists and reveals and everything. Inspector, so that is essential listening. Go and check it out when it's up on Monday. But for the time being, let's concentrate on this week's releases, and let's talk about Brooklyn.
Yeah, this is a very hotly tipped ticket this week. So Saoirse Ronan plays Eilish Lacey, who's an Irish girl from a very small town in, I think it was it Wexford? Waterford? Wexford. Who leaves home for a new life in New York. She's sort of helped along by a protective priest who's played by Jim Broadbent, who sets her up with a landlady played by Julie Walters and a job. And she's trying to sort of find her feet while being crippled with homesickness, because in those days you basically left and, you know, you probably never went back unless you were very, very lucky. But a family tragedy does bring her home just as she's finding her feet in New York, just after she forms a relationship with an Italian-American guy called Tony. And she's called home and finds herself there tempted to stay, because suddenly things are better. Suddenly the outlook is brighter at home. Donald Gleeson as Jim is around, and suddenly there's a guy who might interest her back at home. Her job prospects have suddenly improved, and she's genuinely torn about do I leave all this? Yes, a lot like Natalie Imbruglia. She's torn. Do I leave all this? Do I, you know, go back? Do I leave my family again and find my way in New York? She's torn between these two guys, and she's torn between essentially two lives. It's a really, I don't know, I find it a really affecting dilemma. I mean, maybe because, you know, I'm Irish and I live over here. It's not nearly as far and it's not nearly as big a
shift. And you've been to New York?
I've been to New York.
And you've met two guys?
I have. I'm in the
uncanny
room with two guys right now. It's incredible.
Holy cow. Holy cow.
But no, it's just an affecting drama, because I think it does speak to sort of universal issues.
Yes.
And even if you haven't, you know, had to deal with this kind of dilemma, someone in your family has. You know, my great aunt lived this life around this time, for example. And it just does kind of bring home to you what a big deal it was, and quite frankly, how sort of pioneering and brave people can be to move halfway around the world. Saoirse Ronan's great in it, really, really good. She's very restrained. It's a little bit, I just saw The Hunger Games last night. It reminds me of that sort of level of restraint and buttoned upness, and yet you never have a moment's doubt what she's thinking, what she's feeling, what she's doing.
Oh, she's fantastic, and she's barely off screen.
She is,
as well.
Yeah, carries the film completely.
I think there's maybe two scenes in the film she's not actually in.
Sounds about right.
Maybe, but she's great.
And you know, a great support around her. Emery Cohen as Tony is really charming.
He's
got
American.
A sort of, he's the American. He has a sort of a Brando-iness about him, doesn't he? I think very deliberately. I'm not saying
in terms of his look,
of a little bit of physicality.
Yeah, I'm a nicer character than I think than any Brando character.
Oh yeah,
no question. And that's really interesting about the film that I thought. the dilemma only really comes in the last half hour.
Yeah.
The first hour and a half of the movie, I think, is set up. It's all around Eilish and all around, you know, coming to terms with this homesickness, this appalling homesickness, which just, you know, afflicts her. It's a desperately sad film at times. And then it's a wonderfully hopeful film at times as well. But what I found interesting about it was, and this is based on a novel, which I haven't read. Yeah, which I haven't read, so I don't know whether the dilemma is presented in the same way in the novel. But in movies like this, generally speaking, you get a nice guy who at some point reveals himself to be a dick.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen here. So her dilemma at the end of the movie is, do I go with the genuinely lovely guy in New York or the genuinely lovely guy in Ireland? And then it becomes almost more about hope and freshness and new starts and the old world versus the new. I thought it was a lovely, lovely film. Really did. Yeah, teared up a few times. I'm man enough to say that. I thought Saoirse Ronan was phenomenal, and it's just beautifully written by Nick Hornby. John Crowley directs it with beautiful restraint. Really, really good film.
Yeah, lovely. And we give that 4 stars.
Four stars for Brooklyn. Let's move on now to Burnt, the artist formerly known as Adam Jones, in which Bradley Cooper plays a chef called Adam Jones, who comes to London to redeem himself on the food scene.
I believe this was also the artist formerly known as Chef. I think
yes.
he had that title until another film called Chef with Jon Favreau came along. And I think, to be honest, is probably the superior film.
The Favs,
yeah. Mm-hmm. He did a pretty good job on that. This one comes from John Wells, and it has Sienna Miller, Omar Sy, and Daniel Brühl supporting. Mm-hmm. And Cooper plays this incredibly cocky, demon-ridden chef who's moved to London to sort of start a new life and to chase some Michelin stars. He gets backing from Daniel Brühl in a sort of improbable way.
Creme brulee.
Thank you. And it's essentially, you know, a behind-the-scenes restaurant movie, but without any sort of charm or...
Rat.
Or the soundtrack of Chef, which I think contributed an awful lot to the charm and success of that film.
Yeah.
Not only because it's a film where you want to eat everything.
That's the big difference for me between this and Burnt, because in Chef, there's a scene where he pulls open some barbecued brisket.
Mm.
And
oh my God.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. That noise went around the entire cinema when I saw it. And there's no equivalent to that here, is there?
It's a shame, because this is a fertile topic. I think this is the potential setting for a very good drama. It's a thriller almost, you know. It's a very high pressure environment. You know, there's lots of drama, there's lots of sparks flying, but I don't think it quite pulled it off this time.
It's tricky, isn't it? It's you'd think it's a profession that would be suited to the big screen in a way, because of that hypertension and the fact that, you know, chefs are type A personalities and, you know, they're really driven and they're brilliant. But obviously it's also a very sensory thing, and it's very hard to get that across on screen. And I think one of the things that Chef did and that this film doesn't is that Chef, obviously, he decided at one point to leave the gourmet scene behind and goes off and does a food truck, and that food is much more, there's something you can relate to about, you know, brisket and about tacos. I'm literally drooling. This is bad.
Do you remember that? Do you remember when he grills the cheese sandwich?
Do you remember the scene? Why are we talking about Chef when we're talking about Burnt?
Well,
do you remember the scene where he seduces Scarlett Johansson through the medium of cooking? And
yeah,
I was just
also
like,
he cooks.
I ran out
garlic
and bought a saucepan.
He cooks with garlic pasta and it still works.
Well, of course, garlic's good.
Yeah, but you know, then they kiss. I'm just saying.
It's the only way in which that scenario is even slightly plausible, that someone like Jon Favreau could seduce Scarlett Johansson.
But
you know,
you're saying Happy Hogan and the Black Widow couldn't get it on.
I think she can do better, is all I'm saying.
First podcast and you drop a contra bomb. What? Favs is amazing.
I love Favs. The Favs is my homeboy.
You don't say what you just said and then try and take it back like that. You know, it's fine. You've drawn a line in the sand. You've built a bridge and you've burned it. That's fine.
So tell me, what did we give?
Welcome, John.
Burnt.
So we give.
Burnt. I remember now.
Yes, that's the thing we're talking about. Well, the point I was making was Chef's food was accessible and relatable, and tasty and made you want to eat it. And this is about mission-starred food. And there's Ollie Richards, I think, of this parish, said on Twitter this week, it's a lifeless film about lifeless people making lifeless food. And that's the thing. I mean, mission-starred food is great. Gourmet food is fantastic. And it looks amazing. And I love watching MasterChef, as anyone who knows me knows. But I don't know, on the big screen, it doesn't really...
I think it can. I just don't think it does here.
Okay.
You know, I think there have been better films about food. Even No Reservations, I think, was better. And there you go, I said it. Ratatouille, obviously. Yeah,
that's,
no question.
That's the best sort of cooking film, almost.
Yeah.
We're all forgetting the absolute apex of the genre. Love's Kitchen.
Yeah, we are, Chris. Yeah. That's on purpose.
Quite deliberately.
Has anyone seen that?
Yes,
Love's
I
Kitchen.
Have.
Starring Gordon Ramsay as himself. Right.
We gave Burnt two stars.
Okay, thank you.
Two. Not a recommendation.
Not Mission the Stars either.
And not
no,
rich,
no rosettes of any kind. Okay, that's a bit of a shame. Next up, we have a documentary, He Named Me Malala, Hell's Bells.
Yeah, this is the story of Pakistani activist and teenage schoolgirl, Malala Yousafzai, who was shot in the head by the Taliban at the age of, I think, 15 for speaking out against them and in favour of women's education. She has since become, of course, a figure known worldwide. She has spoken to the UN. She has spoken to governments. She has been to the White House. She has won the freaking Nobel Peace Prize for her campaigning work around the world. She's gone to, you know, to support women's education all over the world, all over Africa, all over everywhere. She can't go back to Pakistan because they have told her if she does, she will be shot. But this is about her life, essentially, both before and after that attack. It's about the background of what turned her into this campaigner and this activist and this fearless woman, much of which comes back to her father. Of course, the he of the title of this film is her dad. He's a wonderful character in this. He's an absolutely fascinating figure himself. It's a great father-daughter film. Genuinely, I came out and immediately wanted to call my dad because it's that kind of movie. Because it's just about how he inspired her and how she inspired him and how they did great things together. And yet she's also a very, very normal person. And it shows her, you know, giggling over pictures of her favourite cricketers that she Googles, and she also fancies Roger Federer, so she's clearly a woman of taste. And, you know, and she just is a really charming figure who also has this incredibly serious, thoughtful, intelligent and outspoken side, which has done so much good and, you know, is beginning to bring so much change in the world. So I thought it was wonderful.
We can see why you liked it.
Outspoken? Never. Anyway, so
Francis
we give
Roger Federer, intelligent, outspoken. Hang on a second.
Anyway, we give this 4 stars.
Four
and it
stars.
Wasn't even me reviewing it. So,
I know. I really want to see this. He Named Me Malala. 4 stars. Probably the pick of the week. It sounds like it's a close second, but it's Brooklyn. This is a film of the week.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. Cannot recommend that film highly enough. Talk about Oscars or just one Oscar. I mean, Saoirse Ronan is good, but I don't think she could win 2 Oscars for the same role.
I mean, it would be unprecedented.
It would be unusual, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it could. I think she's in with the chance. I think at the moment, and we haven't really talked Oscar races yet because it's crazy early. I think at the moment, Brie Larson is the person to beat. Saoirse Ronan's in the conversation.
I read an article this week that said there are 2 locks at the moment. This was an Oscar prognosticator called David Poland who wrote there are 2 locks at the moment in the Oscar race. One is Brie Larson for Room. And the other one, I can't remember. What do you want? Honestly. But yeah, the important thing is Brie Larson. I think it was also screenplay. Or it might have been a screenplay that he thought was a lock.
But Steve Jobs?
No, it wasn't Steve Jobs, funny enough. But it may not even have been a screenplay. But he definitely said Brie Larson in Room. I remember that because I wrote it down. We shall see.
Indeed.
Time will tell. Also out this week, if you want to catch some other movies, there's the gore-flecked zombie flick, Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse, which was formerly known as Boy Scouts vs. Zombies, but then they changed the title. I prefer the original title, I'll be honest. We gave that 3 stars. It's a bit of fun. David Koechner from Anchorman's in there as a zombie scout leader. So if that's the sort of thing that floats your boat, then go see Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse. And also out this week is Kill Your Friend, which is the movie based on John Niven's novel about a A&R executive at a recording company who rises to the top by, well, killing everyone around him. And also, as we talked about last week with Nicholas Hoult, the star of the film, pissing on James Corden.
That's true.
So So there's that. Sadly, the film itself, we didn't like it. We gave it 2 stars. It's ultimately disappointing, although Nicholas Hoult is very good. So there we go. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Natalie Dormer, star of The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2. And of course Game of Thrones and other things as well. So that's always very exciting. Until then, it is goodbye from Helen.
Tiddly.
It's goodbye from the New Jatola.
No.
The New Jeruni.
Closer. New Jack City.
New Jack City. Keep your nickname for John coming in. How was your first podcast, John?
It was good. I hopefully didn't libel anyone, so...
No, you didn't libel anyone, but you launched basically a war against Jon Favreau.
Jon Favreau, if you're listening, I unreservedly apologise. You definitely could go out with Scarlett Johansson.
The views of John Nugent do not represent the views of the Empire Podcast. Just wanted to get that out there. We love you, Favs. Anytime you want to come in and cook us garlic pasta, just saying. What am I saying?
Ew, come in.
Have I just offered myself to Jon Favreau? I think I have, and I think on that note, it's goodbye for me as well. I'm off to go home and get a saucepan out and leave the front door unlocked just in case Favs wants to pop around, apparently. See you next week.